Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Okay, everybody, we are re-releasing a classic All Too Real 2 podcast episode in honor of baseball returning. Here is our classic review of The Sandlot 2. Okay, everybody, welcome to the All Too Real 2 podcast. I'm your host, Michael E. Cohen II. With me, as always, is my co-host, the very enthusiastic Matthew Haas.
What is up?
The sky.
Good to be here.
Okay, that was good, Matt. I'm loving this enthusiasm. Okay, today we're delving into the world of direct-to-video sequels. We're going to do a little series on these. This episode, we will be covering The Sandlot 2, the 2005 direct-to-video film directed by David Mickey Evans and written by him as well. He also wrote and directed the first one, and narrates both.
As different characters.
Yes. Which makes total sense.
Hey, the third one goes into time travel, so like I'm saying...
Yeah, we'll get into that one
later.
This
whole universe might be screwed up.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know. So, I know you have a lot to say about this movie, Matt. I know you just absolutely loved it, right?
Yeah, it was all right. I kind of lied when I said I had a lot to say about it, because, I mean, there's really not much to say, other than it's a decent movie to watch at like 2 in the morning. When, you know, you try to fall asleep and, you know, you don't have to really concentrate too hard to watch it, but you still have to pay attention. I mean, it's not like some weird show about, you know, explosions in the sky or anything like that. I mean, you still have to pay attention a little bit to it, but, you know, other than that, you know, it's a good movie just to chill out to.
So it's, like, better than, like, having the TV off.
Yeah, I think so. Okay. I would say it's better than having the TV off.
Yeah.
It's preferable to nothing. Yes.
Yes.
No, it's not that bad. I'm just kidding.
I know. So.
But it was. You know. I mean. I'm not like some angry, you know, reviewer who's gonna have a heart attack about it or anything like that. But
I'm glad because I don't know any medical training.
Well, yeah.
Of any kind, and I don't want you to die in the studio. Here, yeah. You know, it'd be good.
Yeah.
So the basic storyline here, according to the Internet Movie Database. In the 12 years since the comedic sequel to 1993's Sandlot, a new group of kids have moved into the Sandlot. David Durango, Mac McKing, Saul, and his deaf brother Sammy Fingers, and Tarkel, younger brother Johnny Smalls. And a surprise for Sandlot 2, a girl in the group, ooh. Haley Goodfarer. When Johnny mistakenly sends a model rocket over the junk fence in the Great Fear's yard, the gang must retrieve it, even with the help of the retriever. Who is played by Griffin Riley Evans, who is actually the director's son, by the way. Mm. Anyways, I was wondering why the... no comments here. A kid who steals dog tags and finds the Great Fear is a challenge. Yes, complete with another psychotic name-calling scene with Mac and Little League Captain Singleton. You know, which is very reminiscent of the other. And of course, with James Earl Jones as Mr. Myrtle, I just wonder how much they paid him to be in this movie.
I do have a lot to talk about this, actually.
Okay, so basically, we're kind of retreading the same plot, but instead of the Babe Ruth baseball that got knocked, that got put into Mr. Myrtle's backyard, this time it's a model space rocket for a guy that's working for NASA, who for some reason lives in the San Fernando Valley. I'm pretty sure. I guess you can live outside of, like, you know, Cape, what would have been like Cape Canaveral at the time. I don't know. Did they name it Cape Kennedy at that time yet? I don't know, but that or Houston, or I'm pretty sure those are like the only two locations for NASA headquarters. I mean, I think there is one in Ohio as well, but there, you know, but it's I don't think there's one in the San Fernando Valley where this movie takes place, even though it was shot in Vancouver, Canada. The first movie was actually shot in some other state than California as well. So all of the Sandlot is in the San Fernando Valley of California, but none of them were shot in California from what I understand. So, which is very strange. I don't know. It's like, why place it there if it's not? I don't know. So we're retreading the same thing. We've got, you know, the kids of the Sandlot being picked on by the Little League team. You've got the, you know, they got to have a game to see who's going to get the field and blah, blah, blah. And, you know, you just threw in some, you know, women lib type stuff with girls and stuff, which, I mean, I'm all okay with, but it was way over the top.
I was going to say, they overplayed the whole, oh, her mom's a feminist card. Get it?
Yeah.
Like, who actually really talks like this mom?
Fact.
Like, maybe a few people, but I doubt, if they did, I doubt that person would have a husband in the family, because the people would just be totally, like, bored to death from hearing it. Constantly.
But even if this person existed, I mean, it wasn't just her, it was the girls. It was, I'm all for, you know, I consider myself a feminist. I mean, I'm all for women's rights and everything, but it was way over the top, you know, and like, what kid is going to be name dropping Gloria Steinem?
Right.
I mean, you know, a Toledo native, by the way, but yeah.
Yeah, she is.
Yeah.
even she was, though, was getting like annoyed with it. Like, cause whenever she would try to talk to her mom about something, she would just like quote something. She's like, oh, gee, thanks, Mom. Like, you know, it's like, I'm a fucking kid here. Like, you know, give me something I could
later in the movie, you know, she is like, I mean, at one point in the movie, she is like, you know, name-dropping Gloria Steinem.
I think they just wrote that to try, I don't think her character would say that.
No, but that's what I'm saying. It didn't make sense.
Yeah.
That it made about as much sense as the black kid saying solid, like, three times within the first 20 minutes of the movie or something.
And I want to talk about that, too, the token black character. So at the end, I'm kind of going toward the end of the movie here.
Yeah, no, that's fine. When they're talking
about what happened in people's lives.
Oh, yeah.
So and so created. I like this. So the two white kids created, you know, a hip hop record label.
Yeah.
Which became hugely successful. It was called
Def Jam
Records. Def.
Oh, my God.
Okay.
Bad joke.
But then
the
one black kid, his story is he got abducted by aliens and no one ever saw him again. So it's like, it's always like the black character has to have like this goofy story, because, you know, because you can't take a black character seriously, apparently. So it's gonna be some stupid, like, why couldn't, you know, the black kid have a family or settle down or own a department store? No, he's gotta be abducted by aliens, you know.
But like, not to mention the fact that the two nameless girls in the movie too.
That's right, they had no names.
Yeah, I mean I'm sure they did, but I don't know, they never really said them in the movie. Anyways, the two nameless friends of Haley, at the end, they went on to do the most courageous thing in the world, which was, according to the narrator, which was to raise three kids each. They both had three kids exactly.
Yeah.
And they went on to raise them. They did nothing else with their lives.
No, nothing.
Nothing of any significance. I mean, I'm not saying that, you know, being a mother isn't important, and it is, but it's like, for a movie that's trying to push this feminist, you know, this feminist message, you end the movie with two of your female characters just becoming housewives, basically, according to the way you're talking. And, like, I mean, it just kind of seems counterproductive there.
I mean, it was written by one guy.
Yeah.
That's probably why he didn't have any input from anyone else. So he's like, here's what I think feminism is. It's some wife constantly quoting Gloria Steinem.
Yeah.
It's like, you know what I mean? Like, but it's cool. It's totally cool. It's like,
it's probably the only thing he knew about feminism was he heard the name Gloria Steinem once.
Not to make fun of him, but
no, I mean,
he's a good guy.
I mean, he did make the first one.
Yeah, the first one
but...
was good.
Yeah.
This one's not that bad, actually.
Yeah, I mean, for a sequel, it's not really that bad as we're making it sound. But the other interesting thing, too, about, like, the things at the end, they say something about Haley becoming a model, which seems like another kind of anti-feminist type thing. But they did make her a Olympic softball player.
That's
but
right.
It's funny because... I mean, it said that she would have been an Olympic softball, you know, been on the Olympic softball team and, you know, won some gold medals or whatever. It would have been pretty unlikely because women's softball did not become an Olympic sport until 1996. And this movie takes place in 1972.
As she they were 12 years old at the time.
She would have been around 35 years old. In 1996, very unlikely age for an Olympic softball player. I mean, it's
starting out.
I mean, it's possible, but I don't think many women would be playing softball at 35. That's kind
and just of... starting out. Yeah.
Well, I mean, not necessarily just.
Well, I mean,
out.
Like in Olympics, like if they were in Olympics for 10 years before,
she could have been playing softball for years, and if that was the first year they had an Olympic softball team,
oh yeah,
they might have wanted some experienced people on the team. I guess it. Theoretically, she could have been on the Olympic softball team.
I don't think that's what he was going for. I think it was just over.
Yeah. I don't think he did his research to find out that, you know, it didn't enter the Olympics.
I think
he
wrote this like in a period of like 6 months probably. I think he kind of rushed it.
So I think you're giving him a little bit more leeway here. Six months. I'm not saying like 6 hours.
6 hours, no.
I don't know. I mean, I know people that could write something
better.
Like...
Well, that's the thing. Like you said, it's pretty much a rehash of the first movie with just a few differences here and there. Instead of a baseball, it's, you know, a rocket or like a model rocket. Now, I was even thinking to myself last night because I was getting kind of angry just because, like, the movie's pacing is so erratic.
Yeah.
Because I'd be watching it, and it's like, it's kind of going like your pretty standard linear thing. I'm like, okay, it's not too bad. Then it just kind of goes off in these weird directions. Then they do the obligatory 4th of July scene. Another thing from the first movie, mind you, about the fireworks display.
Oh, yeah.
And how they're playing, like, you know, Spirit in the Sky in one scene. Not from that one, but then it's like, I was just thinking to myself, yeah, apparently they spent all of their money on the soundtrack.
Oh, I know.
The acting because... Like, I mean,
and the effects and everything.
Just Spirit in the Sky, and then there was another song that was relatively.
Oh, there was a lot. They did Taking Care of Business.
That's right. There was another one.
Yeah, and so there were some other. There was a lot of actually decent '70s songs in the soundtrack. I mean, but then again, who knows how much those songs cost? Because some of those songs I hear in a lot of movies, so it's like
it might just be a little bit.
Yeah,
James Earl Jones, like he's.
Yeah, and it wasn't like they were using, you know, the Beatles in this or something, right. You know, which would have cost a lot.
Yeah,
but. I don't know. Yeah, and James Earl Jones probably ate up some of the budget there
just for his
first one scene.
And I was thinking too. I was really sad when that scene happened. Like I was hoping against hope. I'm like, please don't let that be James Earl Jones. Please let it be a different character. And it's like, nope. Turns out, I'm like, oh my fucking god. Like really, it's like, why? Like, so we.
Well, if it makes you feel better, he's not in the third one.
Well, it does make me feel better, actually, because he's too important, I think, to lend himself the face, no matter how much they paid him.
Yeah.
I mean, granted, they offered him, like, $3 million to do 5-minute scene, fine, whatever, but I'm just, like, I'm watching, and I'm like, please. Oh, God,
yeah, who knows how much they offered him? Was it, did you look it up?
No, I'm just saying, like, if it was, like, I'm just saying it's easy money. I mean, you only have to film for, like, one day, and then there you go.
Yeah. I mean, who knows? He could also be friends with the director, too, and maybe did it for him, you know. Who knows?
Yeah. I don't know. I just watched it. And I'm like, oh, God. And like, here we go again with the story about the dog and how it's the son of his old dog who everyone's also afraid of that dog. It's like, dude, maybe you're like a bad dog owner if you constantly have dogs that people are afraid of. Like, I mean, you know.
And my thing is, it's like, Okay, he's blind.
Yeah.
Which we established in the first
movie. Right.
Okay. That I get. Okay. Is he also deaf? Because the... that big art piece that he made.
Oh, yeah. Art piece.
Yeah. That made as a fence, you know, out of old, like, refrigerators and, you know, washers and dryers and stuff. Anyways, it fell down really hard.
Yes.
And he didn't know about it until the kids came to the door to tell him.
We're talking about multiple washers and dryers, like probably at least like 20 or 30 of them. Not to mention all the other scrap metal that makes a loud clang when it lands. Yeah, all of it just completely falls down onto the field. Nothing.
Yeah.
Nothing, but he's listening to records. I don't know what he's doing inside his house. And it's like, that's the other thing too, though. He's blind. That's been established in the first movie. Okay. How was he able to climb up this extremely dangerous structure with washers
and dryer
and build it and call it an art piece? How did he never fall down or have something crush
him? I'm not saying blind people can't make art.
No, I'm not.
But still, it's like, did he have help with this?
Yeah, this is not a regular art piece.
Did the dogs help him with
this? Yeah, maybe his dog helped him push up a dryer up a ramp. I don't know.
I'm just trying to figure out what happened, how they did this. But it's, because, like I said, you know, blind people can be artists. You know, I saw a movie once called Blue that was just a blue screen for 2 hours, but it was a guy because he had contracted AIDS and he was dying and all he could see was the color blue.
Oh, wow.
And he was a filmmaker. I'm trying to remember the guy's name, but he made this movie where it was just basically was a kind of a day in his life, but it was just the audio basically in a like a blue screen.
Oh, like a narration. Okay, cool.
Yeah. It was kind of cool.
I wasn't trying to say that because he was blind, he couldn't make something, but I'm just saying that was no art piece. That was a wall. That was a freaking wall, no matter how you slice it. Like,
yeah.
It was it's like, just like in the first movie, he doesn't want people knocking on his door constantly because all the stupid rumors that are going around about how he's kind of a monster of a pet.
Well, he actually wants them to knock on the door.
Oh, he does?
No, that's what he said, because he goes, why didn't you kids just come to the door?
Oh, yeah, right.
Why didn't you come? And the same thing he did in the first movie. It's like, why didn't you just knock on the door and ask me for the ball? And
right.
This one, it's like, why didn't you just come to the door and ask me for the rocket?
Right.
He's like, I would have gone out and got it for you.
And like, what was his name? Johnny Smalls? Or was that the original character? What's this character?
This kid is Johnny Smalls.
So Johnny knew about this guy, or relatively knew about the story from his older brother.
Yeah.
So how come at no point did he be like, huh, this seems kind of weird. I remember my older brother telling me a story like this. Why don't I go call him and talk to him and ask him
how they settled the deal?
Instead, no, I'm just not going to bother him. I'm just going to figure this out.
It basically just makes the whole point of the first movie kind of moot. I mean, it's like it are like pointless, because these kids, you know, you think that would have been the one thing, because it seemed like after the events of the first movie that those kids would have kind of become friends with Mr. Myrtle.
Yeah.
And maybe if this is his little brother, he would have at least introduced him to him at one point, or mentioned him and said, hey, you know, that guy's a cool dude, you know, or whatever, you know. It's like,
don't be afraid of his dog, you know.
Yeah, or just don't be afraid of him.
Right.
I mean, because regardless of the dog, all you had to do was knock on the dude's door and he would have got you the rocket.
But, you know, we need the movie, you know, so I do kind of like the idea of the rocket,
yeah,
being more high stakes than an autographed baseball. I mean, I do understand.
But then in the end, in the narration, they talk about how the rocket wasn't even that important. It was the blueprints of Mr. Goodfair. It was his blueprints of the rocket. Yeah, and I mean, that's the other thing. Greg German, who played Mr. Goodfair, is actually a pretty well-known actor.
Yeah.
At that time, he wasn't too far off of doing Ally McBeal, which he was on for years. And
right.
So I'm sure they paid him a decent amount of money.
Yeah, I mean, it's...
Even though he wasn't in that many scenes either, but still, it was...
Can I talk about that, too? So,
yeah.
The fact that he has three locks on his door, and then he just somehow forgets to close the door all the way when he's late for his flight. Like, really, like...
He would have had to lock them, though, too. You know, you think he would have at least locked one of them.
Yeah. So, I mean, obviously they needed that to, you know, start the next part of the movie, but I'm just thinking this guy is so secretive about his stuff that he has three locks, and then he just leaves the door open. But also, with the ambiguity of talking to Johnny the day before about, hey, why don't you come over on Friday morning? And so, you know, we'll test out that rocket. So then he sees the door open. So he's like, well, maybe he meant for me to do it. I don't know. You know, then he sets it up, and then he wasn't going to release it until the guy got home. But then he fell asleep, and then he dropped the remote.
My thing is if this parent that I barely knew said, hey, you know, you can come over and, you know, we'll play with rockets. Not I mean, no, that sounded kind of dirty. But, No, but anyways, if your neighbor, when you're a kid, says, hey, you know, we can do this thing at this certain time, you know, whatever kind of adult it is or whatever, I'm not going to just go about myself and set up this rocket.
Right.
And say, oh, it's okay, he'll be here soon and we'll take care of this and do it, you know, no. And think that he's not going to be mad at me for touching, you know, his rocket. That just sounds bad again. I'm sorry.
An actual rocket.
We're talking about it. It looks like a, you know, like, well, like a NASA
model rocket.
Yeah.
But an actual model rocket, not a euphemism. It's an actual model rocket. Too big for any, you know, an enemy to ever.
So.
Wow.
How about them Sandlot kids?
Yeah.
In their baseball.
The Sandlot kids. Let's talk about them. Okay, so.
Yeah. So let's talk about the different characters, too. Yeah. So we've got David Durango, who's basically your Benny from the first movie, you know, in a ways, because he's like the kid that's all about the baseball and all about the girls eventually. But, I don't know.
So, Mr. Cool, sort of.
Yeah. I mean...
not really.
And I mean, the thing is, these kids aren't... I mean, not that the kids in the first movie were great actors. They just seem to have a little bit more chemistry together than these kids did.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm not saying that they didn't have any, but it just seemed like... I mean, David Durango, he's... the guy who played Max Lloyd-Jones, who played him, he's gone on to do other things, like he was in Once Upon a Time and stuff.
Oh, okay. Cool.
But he seems like a decent actor, but... Here in this movie, at times it almost seems like he's bothered by being there.
Yeah.
He just gives this thing like,
why am I doing this?
It's like, am I doing this for the paycheck or what? You know, that sort of thing. It just feels like that to me a little bit. I don't know if you got that same vibe.
Just the whole deal just feels forced to me. I mean, to an extent. I mean, like, you got the only characters I liked the most was Haley, because she was a girl.
Yeah,
and I was tired.
It was something. It was actually a different character.
Yeah, someone that you didn't see before. Like,
because
like you said, everything else is pretty much like a carbon copy of the other characters in some way. So here's someone that wasn't involved, and then of course, you know, then you could add in the new spin to the whole "you play baseball like a girl" thing, because, you know, that was always used as insult. So then she's like, okay, well, you know, I'll strike you out with my super fast softball pitch or whatever. And then, which is interesting too, because they didn't win that game that was supposed to settle the...
No, he just beat
the shit out of the guy.
Yeah.
That's what made him leave. So it's interesting. They didn't win the game. And which again, kind of goes into the whole feminist thing again. So, you know, then it goes back into, you can't hit a girl. It's like the writer... He's like trying to strike this balance, but doesn't really know how. So he keeps going back and forth.
It took a guy to defend the girl.
Exactly.
In a way, so it's kind of like, I don't know if it's hard to say.
I mean, you can still defend someone, but I just like they made it into like the whole, like I think he even literally said knight in shining armor in the narration. Like, I think he literally used the word. So it's like, and then like she even looks back at him and she's like got tears streaming from her eyes because she got hurt. Well, I mean, the guy basically punched her in the boob. I mean, so it's kind of, that's like getting hit in a certain, if you're male, that's like getting hit in a certain area. So it's obviously that would be extremely painful, but, and you know, you would have to be an asshole to even do that just to win, you know, a baseball game. But,
and I mean, and And the girl that played Haley was a decent actress too, Samantha Burton, and she's never done anything since.
Yeah, she was a little bit too like snotty though.
She was a little bit. I mean, it was over the top.
It was over the top, yeah.
But most of them were.
Yeah.
But there's like, I mean, the kid who played Johnny Smalls, James Wilson.
Yeah,
he.
I wasn't a huge fan of him, to be honest.
I don't know how to explain him. He just didn't seem like he seemed like he was really excited to be there, though, at least more than
playing
David.
He was super enthusiastic, but he was, like, out of place the whole time.
Yeah.
Did he even play? Was he even on the team, or was he just always watching?
I think he was just always
watching.
I don't think he ever played, really.
So I guess that's another different thing. The Smalls character wasn't actually on the team to become good at baseball or even want to play baseball.
I mean, he might have played at one point. I don't know.
I don't even remember.
I don't think so. I don't remember either. That's a good thing.
Good thing to look at, yeah.
Yeah, we already talked about Haley. And then Mac, who was the curly-haired blonde kid, who is played by Brett Kelly, and he was also in Bad Santa 1 and 2.
That kid, I was just going to say that. Was that?
Yeah, he was the kid in Bad Santa. I mean, he was good in Bad Santa, but still, the thing about his, he's actually surprisingly also in Slapshot 3, so he's another sequel to a classic movie, sports movie. We should cover that someday.
Yeah.
I've only seen Slapshot 2. I've never seen Slapshot 3. I've, of course, seen the original Slapshot, which is probably one of the best hockey movies ever made. He was in Bad Santa 1 and 2, and he still seems to be pretty active as an actor. He was in Like Mike 2 as well. Direct-to-video sequel to Like Mike. He seems to like to do these direct-to-video sequels to sports movies. Because Like Mike was a basketball movie, and it's like, I don't know. But anyways, he yelled all of his lines. If you watch that movie, he had like...
Yeah, there was no, like, come on, like, there's never a time when you're not yelling something.
Yeah.
Like, That
didn't matter what he said.
Overacting, like, I need to make a point.
Yeah. And, of course, he was kind of like the ham character in the first movie in a way. I mean, he was the chubby kid, so...
And apparently they have to have the same personality because they're fat. So.
But the thing is, though, in the first movie, the kid who played Ham, what the heck is that actor's name?
I know, he was in a bunch of stuff, too.
Yeah, he's actually just recently... he has a recurring role in Glow.
Oh, okay.
Of all things. Huh. It's kind of interesting, and he's actually pretty funny in that. Because I saw him in Glow, and I was like, is that the kid from Sandlot? And it is. He's grown up, you know? He's like in his 30s or whatever.
Excuse me. It's the character from Kick It Out, the Disney movie about soccer, excuse me, which was way better than Sandlot. No, it wasn't, but...
I don't even know if I've ever heard of it.
1995, Kick It Out.
Was it like a Disney Channel movie or
something? No, it was a real movie. Well, I mean, it was a movie that went into the theaters.
Really?
And then they played a song by Hard that goes, Kick It Out! That was part of the whole move, the soundtrack to the trailer. Kick It Out! Dee-dee-dee-dee-dee-dee-dee, or whatever how the song goes. But, you know, and then like, they're like, yeah. Because I think one of the kids had like a really strong kick. And that was like the big gimmick was... The kid could kick real hard so that, like, he would kick throughout the whole field and still score goals. Kind of like Air Bud, which we'll get into maybe in another episode. But,
definitely.
You know, the kid was able to, you know, like, every time he would score a goal, be like, kick it out, or whatever. I don't know. I haven't seen it in, like, 20 years, so I don't remember what happened.
I think you're just making this
up. No, he was in it. Because I remember there was some journey they had to go. They had to discover something. I remember that character, he had snacks, I think, or I don't remember. And then they had to go somewhere after dark. So I don't even remember. They looked for something. Who knows? It was some weird thing they had to do.
Are you sure this wasn't like some kind of dream?
No, it was a real
movie. Okay, just making sure.
And then he was also in Son-in-Law.
Oh, yeah.
With
Paulie Shore. With the Weasel.
Yeah, Weasel.
Yeah. Paulie's, this is the second time I've talked about him today. I had an interview earlier today and we talked about Paulie Shore. But anyways, just randomly. But anyways, his mom just passed away recently, which is sad. Mitzi Shore. But we're getting sidetracked
here. Yeah, a little bit.
So then we had Saul and Sammy, the brothers, who were the kind of lanky kid, and then his deaf brother, who they called Fingers.
Yeah,
because he talked with his fingers.
I guess that's the reason why they go. Yeah.
Yeah, it kind of seemed a little insensitive to deaf people, in my opinion, a little bit. But I guess it's
1972.
Yeah.
I thought it was because he was handsy with women.
Yeah, but
that's another thing, too. Apparently sexual harassment's cool as long as you're 12 years old.
That's what I was...
Not harassment, assault, sorry.
Yeah, that's what I was about to bring up. It's like Sammy goes to the kissing booth that he finds some platform shoes and puts them on and goes to the kissing booth at the carnival, you know, because we have another carnival scene just like the first movie.
Yep.
Because we got to hit all the marks.
Yep. yep.
But in this one, but instead of, people puking on a ride, we get Bigfoot shit and
that's right. A Bigfoot shit.
And also, a sexual assault scene,
which also hits the mark from the first
from the Wendy Peppercorns thing from the first one.
So they had to put that in the same. They had to kind of go for broke and do a twofer.
Yeah,
at the carnival scene instead of the pool scene. But
because they probably just couldn't afford to get a pool.
No, they had Haley's pool
and
her house, but that's the only thing they could afford.
Ground pool in the backyard because. I don't know.
Budgetary reason.
Yeah. I'm not sure, but I mean, I guess people have above ground pools in California. I don't know. I don't live there, so I don't know. But I always just seem to think, when I think of California, I always think of in ground pools and, but I'm
especially
sure.
Especially the 70s, man. That would be like the pinnacle of in ground.
Yeah. Pools. But this was shot in Vancouver. So, yeah.
That's right.
But needless to say, though, Sammy goes up to the girl, and the girl, I think, is billed as, I can't remember. Let me see here if I can find this really quick. She was billed as, I thought the billing for her was just kind of, she was billed as hot young lady in the credits.
Wow.
Yeah.
Not even kissing booth woman or.
No, they just called her hot young lady.
Wow.
I just thought that was, and then the guy who is in there too is billed as that pulls Sammy off of her when he sexually assaults her is billed as boyfriend.
There's no indication whatsoever that he was her boyfriend.
No, I thought he was just a dude working with her.
That's what I thought too. Like he was a bodyguard, etc.
Yeah.
If anyone tries to get too handsy, he just throws them out. That's what I thought he was.
I thought maybe he was just another carnival worker.
And plus, why would her boyfriend just be standing around while she's working? Like, that's so weird. Does I have another job there or something? Just like, all right, I'll go to work with you and just watch you
kiss a bunch of dudes.
Until some
Cause
kid.
Because there's nothing that I personally, if I had a girlfriend, would want to do more in my life than watch her get kissed by a bunch of guys.
I mean, they're all cheek kisses, But still. And of course, the final straw is, some kid, completely going to town on her. I mean, some 12-year-old.
And then steals her gum. And then later on in the credit part where they talk about his future, he creates some kind of gum company called Kissing Booth Gum or something, which was lame.
I love how, all their futures have to have something to do with that one summer. Like, nothing before or since has happened to them is any way influenced their lives that would warrant...
Because everything that's ever happened in my life happened the summer that I was 12.
Yeah.
You know.
Just that summer.
Yes.
No other summer, no other time of any other year.
No, no. I honestly don't even remember what I was doing when I was 12.
Neither do I.
I think I was working when I was 12, but still, it's that summer. I mean,
that summer, like, I was in the factory in Tacoma.
No, I used to work out at the Toledo Mudhens baseball games, speaking of baseball.
Mudhens?
Yep.
Hentone. Sorry. I miss Terry. What's it called? Hentown?
No.
Oh, I thought they called it Hentown.
No.
Oh, okay. Maybe I just
Henville, maybe?
Hensville.
Yeah. And then Mudville and different things you can call
Hentown
it.
Sounds better than Mudville to me. Mudville yeah. sounds almost dirty.
They wanted to call the downtown by the stadium, the newer stadium. I still call it the new stadium, even though it's been around for like
16 years, 2002.
But they have a little area called Hensville, and they wanted to call it Mudville, but they couldn't legally for some reason. So yeah, I think it has to do with the whole the whole poem, the Mudville, Casey at the bat poem. Baseball poem. Anyways, it's a famous poem.
Oh, okay.
But anyways, we're sidetracked here. So, okay, we got a...
Got an arrow in on the...
Yeah, so we also have... I guess the two girls were called Penny and Jenny.
Okay.
The two nameless girls.
I don't remember them being
I don't remember their names ever being called that, but in the credits, they're credited okay. as Penny and
Maybe
Jenny.
They were called... I just don't remember.
I don't know. But anyways, and, you know, the ones that went on to be courageous and have three kids each.
Each.
Yes.
Because I guess it was a
exactly three. At least they didn't say something like 2.5 kids or something.
Right.
Because I don't know how you have half a kid. Yeah. But then you have Tarkel, the character that bothers me the most in the movie, which we kind of talked about already. But, you know, the one that says, he's your stereotypical token black character.
Mm-hmm.
And it's been a while since I saw the first Sandlot. I don't remember the black kid in that movie, if he had a decent character or he was written well or not. But this character, it just seems like he was an afterthought. It's like, let's get a black kid with an afro and put him in the movie. That's all they did. I mean, it was like, and have him say solid a few times.
And also...
And give the black power, you know... fist.
Did he do that?
Yeah.
Oh my god.
Yeah. He gave the black power fist and went solid at the same time. I don't know. He did it at least, it was like at least two or three times I was counting in the first 20 minutes of the movie.
Wow.
I know it was at least twice in the first 20 minutes of the movie.
And I know he kept talking about when what's the Durango kid's name? First name?
David.
David. When David, first met Haley and was gonna try to talk to her, but he was too shy, and then she ends up leaving, and then they ride up and say, hey, let's go play some, go to the Sandlot, and then he's like, oh, she's liberated, and he kept using that word liberated,
yeah,
like three different times, like, I told you she's liberated, her mom has Miss Magazine. Miss Magazine, that's the magazine that Gloria Steinem edits or whatever.
Yeah, and that was the second name drop of Gloria Steinem.
Yeah, that's what I'd say. I think he just looked up the word feminism, and then
Gloria Steinem's name.
Her name popped up. He's like, okay, I'll just throw her name in the movie.
He read her Wikipedia page.
Yeah, I think that's what it was. I mean, that's what it sounds like. And then it says Miss Magazine. Okay, I'll just make a quick reference to that. Because just the whole liberated, these buzzwords that were thrown around in the 70s, but they were thrown around by college, like ultra liberal college professors. Well, they weren't just regular people saying.
No, it's like when you see in a movie like where everybody's using like the cool slang or the cool whatever, you know, it's like your average kid, 12-year-old kid, isn't going to be using solid or.
Right.
Name-dropping Gloria Steinem.
Right.
I mean, I'm sure there's instances of that happening. But two kids in the same group of kids mentioning Gloria Steinem.
And they're not at all connected to each other.
No, and they're different scenes.
Yeah. And they're completely from different, families, so they don't even hang out with each other. Just totally,
no.
Yeah, on their own. No.
I just don't see that. I mean, and how many, I mean, my thing is, it's like, if you're going to make references here in the 70s, you know, why don't we talk about the Brady Bunch or the, or Partridge Family or something that is more popular to kids.
Right.
I mean,
you know, to actual kids.
Yeah.
Yeah. Your fake made up version of what you think.
Yeah.
Kids. Cause like, you know, when she called the guy a male chauvinist pig, he's like, that's what my mom calls my dad. I'm like, what? Where do you guys live? Do you guys live like in a group community where like everyone is like a commune or something like
yes.
that? I mean, that would make sense that I can get that because everyone has the same teacher or philosophy or whatever.
I didn't grow up in the San Fernando Valley. I don't know. Maybe that's what it's like there.
Maybe it is. Yeah. Maybe they like got into the Rajneesh stuff before it became popular. I don't know. And then they just...
I don't know. And it's just...
Not really.
I don't get that. I mean, my thing is too, and plus these kids that love baseball and it's during the summer, never mention a baseball player.
Right.
If you're talking pop culture things that you want to reference, you know, like no mention of any of the, you know, Dodgers that are playing, because that would be the team they'd be into because they're in Southern California
yeah.
probably, and one of the kids is wearing an LA hat. And it's just, I don't know. I mean, it's like, my thing is, it's like, When I was a kid, I used to have a little wiffle ball league in my backyard, which consisted of me and my friend Carl. And I'm going to emphasize that again. It was a league that consisted of me and my friend Carl.
So just two people.
And my friend Carl Welch, if you're listening. Hi, how's it going? Anyways, we set up a whole system or whatever where we were every team in the major leagues. He was half of them, I was half of them, or at least we were at least in the American League or whatever like that. But, you know, he was half of them, I was half of them. And we knew, we collected baseball cards, and we knew, and we played in the backyard. I mean, that's the closest thing to like a sandlot type of deal that we had. But, I mean, there was only two boys in my neighborhood, so that's why it was just Carl and I. And so, but anyways, my thing is when we would talk, we would mention the names of players that were on the Yankees or the Tigers or whatever team we're pretending that we're playing, you know, we'd pretend like, oh, coming up to bat is, you know, Alan Trammell or whatever, you know, something like that. We'd mention a player. These kids don't even talk about baseball. Mm-mm. And I know the movie's not about baseball, but it just seemed weird to me that they didn't bring up any baseball players, though. The exasperated coach of the Little League, the bad boy Little League team, was Steve Garvey, who is a famous Major League Baseball player back in the day. Yeah, so his little cameo in there, too. I'm wondering if that cost them money, too. That might have been where some of the budget of this film went.
Yep.
But, yeah. I don't know. It's just...
It's interesting.
Just interesting. Like... film. Few little bits of like trivia here before we wind down here about this. As these are some of the things that are wrong with the movie, like some anachronisms and stuff like that. As the model of the space shuttle flies over the city, it goes over a Foot Locker. The movie takes place in 1972. Foot Locker did not exist until 1974. The model of the space shuttle includes a rust-colored external fuel tank. In the early flights of the space shuttle, the tank was painted white. Most likely, if any models existed during development of the shuttle, that would have had a tank painted white. Those are just simple, you know, little things. When the kids were first upset that the girls were at the sandlot, one of the boys asked another boy, "Are you on crack?" This movie is set in 1972, but crack was unknown to most people until 1981.
Yeah, that's a little bit so, for crack.
So yeah, there's a few little. I always like it when you're having a movie that is set in a time period. The little things that people get wrong, like if you have, you know, the wrong kind of shoes on or the wrong hat or the wrong car or whatever. But these are things that are just right in the dialogue or the. Or, you know, they're prop things, you know, that yeah. could have been easily researched and fixed. Like Foot Locker not existing until 1974.
Yeah. What about the Nike part? when the David puts on his Nike shoe, was Nike around?
Yeah, Nike.
Check it out. Sorry.
So tell us more about that movie, Matt.
Kick It Out. I don't remember much. I remember.
Are we sure it wasn't a dream?
I'm pretty sure that the kid was in it and that he liked to eat snacks. And then there's part where they had to
actually
do something, sneak somewhere.
So 1972 would have been the first year that the company was called Nike.
Oh, okay.
Prior to that, it was Blue Ribbon Sports.
Okay.
I remember watching a documentary about this, but I just looked it up on Wikipedia. I'm not going to say that I knew that off the top of my head, folks, because we just killed time to have me look it up. Anyways,
yeah, don't take credit for
Wikipedia.
For, yeah, what Wikipedia tells. Kick It Out by Heart. See, I told you it was a...
I believe that's a song. I've actually seen Heart in concert, so I know this. One of the first concerts I ever went to as a kid was a Heart concert. It was Heart and Cheap Trick.
Awesome. That's a great... I could have sworn that I've not seen anything. Maybe it was a dream. I could have sworn that there was a movie, The Big Green. That's...
Yeah, I've heard of that movie.
Okay.
Okay. Mind. So it wasn't...
It was called The Big Green. I was wrong, but...
Okay.
But
they did have that song in the movie.
They had a song, Kick It Out. I don't know why I thought it was called Kick It Out, but...
Well, you probably would have thought it was called that because the song was...
And then here's a picture of it.
Yeah, I have heard of that movie. I don't think I've seen it.
Very sad that he had to subject himself to that type of gimmicky stuff. But hopefully they paid him a decent amount of cash for it.
I'm sure. Anyway, so would you recommend this movie... Sandlot 2. Do you think this... Okay, here's a better question. Was this sequel necessary?
No.
Do you think the sequel was just a cash grab?
Yes. I don't think that he needed to write... I don't think so, because there is nothing that he added of any value other than the character of Haley. That was like, if he wanted a sequel... where it was about a girl's team or a girl, let's say, who's trying to stand up against prejudice and wants to play baseball, and then she proves everyone wrong that says that girls can't play baseball, something like that. But
we already saw that movie. It was called The Bad News Bears.
Right. It was a good movie.
Yeah, I'm just saying,
they bring...
seen it a couple times because it was in a TV series.
Then they made a remake.
Yeah, that's the same. We saw it a couple times and a TV series. Because they had the remake with Billy Bob Thornton speaking of Bad Santa. But anyways,
so they brought that character in, but then that didn't even become her character after that. It was just like she was just a character. It was like, oh, okay. So
that became a typical girl love interest.
Yeah, I mean, that could have been a nice thing, but then
that was the other thing at the end I found really weird. It's like, they went together all through high school, and then they broke up, and then they, 10 years after college, ran into each other again, and he was still afraid to talk to girls, and not saying that that's not true, but then it's like, you're supposed to say, will you marry me? And then they got married.
That's a weird way to propose to somebody that you haven't seen in over 10 years.
Yeah, I mean,
that's weird, like... You just show up.
I mean, how much of life has she not dated anybody else in 10 years? Has he not dated anybody else in 10 years? Have, by that time, if you think about it, 10 years after college, you're like in your 30s.
Right.
You're pretty well established in life by most people. Most people are. I mean, I wasn't, but,
I'm just saying, so they met, how do they meet? For one thing, and like, was it an intentional meeting, or did they just run into each other? Because if they just ran into each other, it makes the whole situation much more weird. So
seems creepy.
If you meet someone that you haven't seen 10 years after college, which we don't even know if it was just 10 years or just 10 years after college.
I mean, if one of my girlfriends from high school came up to me, like, 10 years ago or right now even.
And you didn't say anything.
And I didn't say anything, and I just saw them, and I'm like, whatever, and I'm just dumbfounded or whatever. And then she, the first thing out of her mouth is, "You're supposed to say, will you marry me?" I would be like,
"What?" Like,
I'd be like, "Girl, I've had a life here. I don't know what's going on with you. You could be psycho. You could have killed four people yesterday, right. And I don't know that, you know? I mean."
Yeah. I mean, I guess that was his way of trying to be romantic. But again, I think the guy doesn't really know how to write. I mean, I know he knows how to write, but I don't know how to explain it.
He has written other things.
I really shouldn't be trash talking.
No, I mean, he's, I have nothing against the guy. It's just, he didn't write the third movie in the series.
Oh, really? The time travel one?
Yeah, which I really want to see soon. I saw it once before a long time ago, probably when it first came out.
That one might be more fun to watch, even if it is bad. But
yeah,
it might be more fun because it time travel is involved in a plot movie.
So maybe we'll cover that on the next step and on the episode following this one. But David Mickey Evans, the writer of this, the writer and director, he wrote the movie Radio Flyer before he did Sandlot.
Oh, okay.
He actually had started to direct it. I had read somewhere, and the studio was not happy with it, so they brought in Richard Donner to finish the movie. But then the first movie he directed officially was The Sandlot. Then he directed The First Kid, starring Sinbad.
Sorry.
Yeah, I know. He directed Beethoven's Third.
Oh, God.
And Beethoven's Fourth.
Oh.
He did National Lampoon's Barely Legal, some movie called Wilder Days, did The Sandlot 2, did a movie called The Final Season, which is another baseball movie. He directed the movie Ace Ventura Pet Detective Jr. And some other things. But as far as a writing goes, He wrote the Ace Ventura movie.
Okay.
He gets a writing credit on Sandlot Heading Home, which is the third Sandlot movie, but he didn't write it at all. He just created the characters. He wrote the screenplay for Mickey, Donald, Goofy, the Three Musketeers movie. He wrote the screenplay for the baseball Matt LeBlanc monkey movie called Ed.
That was actually one of my favorite movies when I was a kid. I watched that constantly.
See, I was like a senior in high school when that came out, so that was kind of, I never saw that one.
That's why I became obsessed with chocolate bananas, because that's what the monkey was always eating.
Was chocolate bananas.
And I was trying to figure out how to freeze them without making them taste like crap. Didn't work, but.
Yeah, he also wrote TV movie Journey to the Center of the Earth.
Okay.
With this one that features Tim Russ from Star Trek Voyager, and I'm not recognizing any other name in the cast here.
Some hit and misses.
Hit and misses.
I mean, you know, hey, sometimes you got to take the work if, you know.
My thing is regardless of anything else he did, Sandlot, the first Sandlot, is a classic.
It is.
I mean, I personally don't hold it up as high as most people, but then again, in 93, I was in a freshman in high school.
You were like 15 or 14 at
the time. Yeah, so I was kind of older, so it was never like that. You know, it's not like, I don't know, like The Princess Bride or Star Wars or something like that, where it was a movie that I saw a lot as a kid, or Spaceballs. That was the one I watched a lot as a kid. I don't know, But as far as like coming of age movies, I'm trying to think of anything that would be on the same par as that, because like when I was a kid, there were only, I mean, I guess a lot of people would go to Goonies, but I never watched Goonies because that was like right before my time, sort of. I mean, it was still within my time, but I was never a fan of Goonies. It's not that I, speaking of Richard Donner, he directed that. Anyways, but who also read, but Radio Flyer I liked.
Yeah, Radio Flyer was
But that was still a little bit. When I was older,
so that was like 92,
yeah.
I think.
Yeah, it was like right before Sandlot, and but I don't know if I ever had like a coming of age kids movie that I watched, you know, like Sandlot, that actually resonated with me. There probably was one that I'll think of later, but I never held it up on that pedestal that a lot of people do. Because, I mean, a lot of people, they have these movies like that, or like some people have The Goonies, some people have, you know, I guess maybe for me it was E.T. or something, maybe. It was probably my movie that was like a kind of coming-of-age kid sort of movie. I don't know.
Huh.
It's hard to say because, I don't know, E.T. was the first movie I ever saw in theaters.
That's a good one. My brother saw that too in theaters. I saw Sandlot in theaters with my dad and brother.
Yeah,
so that was...
I honestly don't think I saw Sandlot until I was in my 20s.
Oh, okay.
So it never really
yeah.
resonated with me. So, I mean, I respect the movie, and I think it's a great movie. As a great coming-of-age kids movie. But it's hard to put it up on a pedestal for me. It's not like one of my sacred cows when it comes to movies.
Yeah.
But I understand the reverence that people have for it. And so making a sequel is something that a lot of people are going to be slapped in the face with. It's kind of like, I don't know, there's a lot of movies where they make direct-to-video sequels, and I'm like, why the hell did they do that? You know, probably most of the time, honestly. But, and I felt kind of the same way with this one, but I have this weird fascination with sequels. And I liked this movie. If the first one didn't exist, it would be a lot better. But it was so similar to the first
movie right.
that it was a retread that wasn't really necessary. I mean, putting it in the 70s was cool, adding the women's lib girl aspect to it, but not the over-the-top Gloria Steinem stuff. But it had enough differences to make it a unique enough movie, but it was still basically the same plot. And I don't know. I wouldn't recommend it to anybody, but if you, like you said at the beginning of the show, like if your TV's off and that's not enjoyable for you, and for some reason the only DVD you have is this movie, and there's no access to the internet or any other kind of entertainment.
In other words, if it's like I Am Legend, and you're Will Smith's character, but instead of having like DVR of Shrek or a bunch of other movies, you only have The Sandlot 2, then I guess that's where you're going to be stuck watching for the rest
yeah.
of your life.
I mean, he was lucky in the fact that he got to go to that video store
oh, and
movies all the time in that movie.
That's, I mean, yeah, so he got lucky
yeah.
with that. But
yeah.
if you're that character and you only had that to watch, I guess that'd be all right.
Yeah. I mean, if you're trapped on a desert island with a TV with a built-in DVD player that has Sandlot 2 stuck in it,
I mean, yeah.
Yeah, watch it.
I just feel sad for the people whose coming-of-age movie is The Sandlot 2. Like, if, like two kids or two guys are just talking about, like, yeah, you remember when we were 12, we watched Sandlot 2 together that one summer every night?
I mean, there are some people that do that. Like, I mean, I know people, like okay, it's kind of like what you attach to. Like, I've listened to the podcast How Did This Get Made? Sometimes in June Diane Raphael on there, they did an episode about Grease 2. Mm-hmm. She liked it better than Grease because when she was a kid, she only had a couple movies, and one of them was Grease 2. Mm-hmm. And so that movie that you watch over and over again, it's kind of like, which is kind of funny because the opposite effect happened to me with the original Grease. My sister had that tape and watched it and listen to the soundtrack over and over again, I began to absolutely hate Grease with a passion. So then when she actually did get Grease 2, I got excited too. So kind of like I had the opposite reaction to the first movie that she had to the second movie. So I actually did have a similar reaction to the second movie. I was like, oh, it's something different. But like, you know, when I was a kid, we didn't have that many movies. You know, we had like a VHS of stuff we recorded off of TV where we had like Mr. Destiny and... Oh, that was the other one. My sister loved Three Men and a Little Lady. Not Three Men and a Baby, but Three Men and a Little Lady.
Yeah.
And that was on that tape that we had, like Mr. Destiny, Three Men and a Little Lady, yeah. and I can't remember, there's some third movie.
I'm familiar with the VHS tapes and that movie on, yes.
Yeah. Mm-mm. Yeah, and she watched that one over and over again. And honestly, I think I like it more than the first one only because I saw it more. It kind of just got indoctrinated in my head. It's like when you like a song just because you've heard it more. Like if there's a song on Top 40 radio and they play it enough, eventually you know all the lyrics and you start to sing along. Doesn't necessarily mean the song's good.
Right, it just means that you've heard... Well, Three Men and a Little Lady, that was terrible for me because during that time, my aunt was obsessed with, like, spirits and, like, haunted Ohio stuff or whatever. And, like, she had, I guess, heard this theory. This is pre-internet, by the way.
That wasn't Three Men and a Baby.
No, Three Men and a Little Lady. The one I'm talking about, too.
No, there's a haunting in the Three Men. There's a supposed haunting in the Three Men and a Baby. I've never heard about one.
Oh, well, what I was told then was about someone was supposed to be hanging from a ghost that looked like they hung themselves, like some kid that was in the background, but it was supposed to be a spirit. It wasn't supposed to be a real human. It was like
what I heard, there was in the first movie that there was supposed to be like a ghost or something in the background of one of the scenes, but it turned out that when you slowed down the footage and everything,
later, that's what it was.
It's in the first movie.
Okay.
Yeah, and it was actually just a cardboard cutout of Ted Danson.
Oh, God. But that freaked me out because I was like a little kid.
Because his character was an actor and he had a cardboard cutout.
Oh, sorry.
And it was in the background of the scene, so it looked like a ghost in the shot. But it was proven later to be a cardboard cutout of Ted Danson. So, yeah.
And this was pre-internet, too.
Yeah.
So these things still it's cycle.
Yeah, I mean, we should do an episode where we cover stuff like this.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, you have the whole, like, the hanging thing, too. You did have the supposed Munchkin hanging himself in the background of Wizard of Oz.
Maybe that's where I got confused.
Transposed to or something. Yeah. But anyways, just be sure to follow us on Facebook and all that good stuff. Anything else you want to say, Matt?
Nope, that's it.
All right. Have a good one, folks.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to All Too Real 2 Podcast, a Cullen Park production. Produced and edited by Michael E. Cullen II. Music by Matthew Hawes. Subscribe and share the show. Visit us at cullenpark.com.